We're at the Systems, Biology and Physical Foundations of Aging workshop at the Santa Fe Institute with Daniel Promislow, who's a geneticist from the University of Georgia. So first of all, welcome. And next, let me go to your paper that you published in 2008, A Theory of Age-Dependent Mutation and Senescence. Could you gloss the basic story that you're telling in there?
Sure. This is work that a postdoc in my lab, Jake Morad, did. And the original evolutionary theories of aging date back to the early 20th century and then were really cemented by Peter Medawar. And the idea is that organisms are constantly exposed to natural selection. And if you inherit some mutation from your parent, from one of your parents, that reduces your fitness, reduces either your ability to survive or your ability to reproduce, the two really key components of fitness, natural selection will get rid of that mutation. You'll be less likely to pass it on to your kids. And so over evolutionary time, those kinds of mutations will tend not to spread. Beneficial mutations that increase your ability to survive or to reproduce will spread.
And there are some mutations, of course, which appear to be deleterious, like sickle cell anemia and so on, but actually had fitness enhancing qualities in the environment in which they evolved.
That's right. And in those cases, you get this interesting situation where they don't go to fixation because there are some bad things about them, but there are some beneficial things and they're maintained at some equilibrium. Now there are also mutations, and this was Medawar's idea. There are some mutations that are deleterious that an organism inherits from its parent, but the effects of that mutation don't occur until later in life. One example that many people are familiar with might be something like Huntington disease. The HD mutation, the Huntington disease mutation, definitely can reduce fitness. It reduces survival, but it isn't expressed until quite late in life. And here's the key idea. If someone is carrying a mutation like that, but they don't know it, and it's not expressed until they're 60 years old, or maybe 50 years old, by which time they will have had kids, maybe their kids will have had kids, that mutation, even though it is very deleterious, it's lethal, it gets passed on, and natural selection doesn't see it because it doesn't express itself until late in life. Now, the Huntington disease mutation is quite dramatic, but imagine that there are thousands of tiny little mutations with tiny little effects that don't occur until late in life. And in the aggregate, it's like we're carrying all these tiny, tiny little ticking time bombs. And as we get older and older, more and more of them go off. They're tiny, so they don't do much damage. But in the aggregate, as we get older and older, more of these mutations have their deleterious effects. And natural selection doesn't get rid of them because they're expressed late in life. So in general, we can say that the later a mutation is expressed, the less likely or the less able natural selection is to get rid of that mutation. So that's the background for that paper.
Now, when you say expressed late in life, of course, the double whammy here, in that by extending lifespans, we're now creating a field in which these things that nobody even really knew about then start appearing.
If Medawar's idea is true, then, and we think that the general principle has to be true, then that's exactly right. So there's kind of a, Tom Kirkwood might say there's a selective shadow. And as we live longer and longer, that shadow gets bigger and bigger, and we may uncover more and more late-acting, deleterious effects of these mutations that we wouldn't have normally seen. That may be, for example, why we now see a lot of Alzheimer's disease, whereas in the 19th century we didn't, because people weren't living that long. So there wasn't time for those genes to have, for the effects of those genes to be expressed.
This is a slight off-ramp, but I'd like to follow it up anyway. The notion of personal genomics as it applies to all of these things. The more dramatic cases, of like Huntington's disease, where you've seen the stories of Nancy Wexler, a researcher who actually has it, and so on, and the agony of thinking about, do I want to know about this, and so on and so forth. As more personal genomics becomes cheaper and so on, companies like 23andMe, these choices then start becoming much more prevalent. Do I want to know about this? How many of these things do I want to know about? And so on. This is going to be a real issue, isn't it?
Well, and let me add one more complication. So Medawar came up with his ideas in the 1940s and 1950s. The next big leap in evolutionary thinking was put forward by George C. Williams in 1957, who suggested that these late-acting deleterious mutations might actually be favored by natural selection if they have beneficial effects early in life. So imagine a gene that undergoes some mutation and an organism inherits that mutation. It increases their ability to have offspring when they're young, but at some cost of survival later in life. So you get back to personal genomics. We may identify some beneficial mutation that is somehow improving fitness early in life, but has some cost. We may identify some mutation that we think is deleterious late in life and not realize that it actually has beneficial effects early in life. So I think, and one of the things that we learn at a meeting like this workshop on systems biology is that nothing is ever as simple as we think it is. And there are likely to be complicated side effects of, you know, any gene. So let's say that we discover there's a particular gene that's associated with shorter lifespan, or a particular allele, a particular type of a certain gene. That allele is associated with shorter lifespan. The first question that you're asking is whether I want to know about that. And the other important thing to realize is that the particular effect of that allele may depend on other genes in my genome, and there may be some deleterious effects. There may be some beneficial effects that we don't realize. So making any sort of, I don't know what sort of decisions we would make, it raises all sorts of ethical questions, but the systems biologist would say, we need to be careful because things are very complicated.
Could you just put into context what we mean at this meeting by systems biology? Sydney Brenn at the Salk Institute, for example, would say that we already have it. He would say it's just physiology with advertising. So from your perspective, how would you define systems biology, or if you don't want to?
I don't think of myself as a systems biologist, so I hesitate to define it, because if you ask 10 different people, you'll get 10 different definitions. I don't know what the right definition is. What interests me about what systems biologists are doing is that they're recognizing the need to think seriously about interactions, that biological systems are nonlinear systems, by which I mean, if you recognize or identify a gene that's associated with some phenotype, some physical expression of a trait, and you identify another gene that's associated with a phenotype, there's a good likelihood that those two genes are interacting in some way that isn't just adding one on top of the other. Mm-hmm. They're interacting in some complicated or nonlinear way. And systems biology, I think, is recognizing that and embracing tools to actually look at what those interactions are. For example, the whole concept of networks really is about complicated interactions between multiple traits. And so I think a key component of systems biology is recognizing interactions between genes, between different levels of organization, between cells and organs and so on.
So I suppose you have this kind of two-stranded approach. You can use a very reductionistic approach and drill down and look at the cell or the neuron, but then you're missing the system and the interconnectivity. So
that's right. And as an evolutionary biologist, I would say, well, let's imagine that we're looking at some important fitness trait, like I work on fruit flies, and we're looking at the number of eggs that a fruit fly lays, and imagine that there's some mutation that increases the rate at which eggs are being laid. Well, natural selection can act on that gene, but natural selection is going to see, in a sense, all of the genes in the organism. It's going to, and the fitness of that organism is going to depend not just on that gene that increases the number of eggs that are laid, but all the other genes in that organism, the environment with which the organism is interacting. So evolution doesn't act on just one individual gene. It's looking at the entire organism and all the different genes that are there and the metabolites and so on. So if we're thinking about the evolution of traits, sometimes we like to make things very simple because we can understand them, and we've been very successful in many ways at looking at very simple pathways. But natural selection is really looking at the big picture. And so that's the challenge for us, to also look at the big picture.
So could you just give me a quick tutorial, a sort of evolutionary biology 101, and define some of these terms that we'll be using? A lot of this work goes back to George Williams, the great evolutionary biologist, who talked about the adaptive fitness of an organism. So let's start with fitness. Obviously, it's not about molecules running down the hall in sneakers. So,
that's right.
Yeah. So in fact, that's a very precise term of art, and I'd like to get a definition of that. And then there's this other word, pleiotropy. So could you have a go at those?
Sure. So fitness is a simple definition of fitness is simply the ability of an organism to pass its own genes on to the next generation. And we think of fitness components as those traits that influence the ability of an organism to pass genes on to the next generation. And the simplest way to do that is to have kids. And the rate at which you do that, or have kids, is going to depend on your fertility or fecundity and on your survival. You need to be able to produce eggs if you're a fruit fly, or to fertilize eggs if you're a male fruit fly, and you need to survive to an age when you can do that. Of course, there are other ways in which you can increase your fitness without actually having kids. For example, you can increase the probability that your genes are passed on to the next generation if you assist your relatives. For example, if you assist a brother or a sister who carries 50% of the genes that you carry to have more kids, then indirectly you're increasing your fitness. But generally the currency of fitness is having kids, passing genes on to the next generation. Pleiotropy. This is important in aging theory. Because going back to Williams, he suggested that aging evolves because there are genes with what he called pleiotropic effects. A gene that has pleiotropic effects is a gene that has multiple effects, that affects multiple traits. So pleiotropy is just a measure of the degree to which a gene affects multiple traits. So for example, we might imagine a gene that increases the ability to sequester calcium, which is obviously important for fetal growth, but at the cost of hardening of the arteries late in life. Those would be pleiotropic effects, one gene with two separate effects.
I don't want to sound too teleological here, but once you've achieved your fitness in the sense of passing on your genes, in a sense, you've done the job, right? So at that point, the aging process starts, you could argue, and the only reason that we live a long lifespan now is because of better sanitation, better medications, and so on, which is in a peculiar sense, being a bit controversial here, a bit unnatural. Do you think that's going a bit too far?
Sure, it's going a little bit too far. So humans are still certainly we're a product of natural selection. We're also continually a part of the process of natural selection. We've invented this culture. Here we are in a library, which is a wonderful example of, it's a representation of thousands and tens of thousands of years of cultural evolution. Despite all of these artifacts, we still are subject to natural selection. when diseases sweep through human populations, something that's all on our minds right now with the swine flu, that's an opportunity for natural selection to have a big impact. So is our long lifespan now unnatural? Well, if you include, if we think broadly about evolution to include cultural evolution, for whatever reason, we evolved certain abilities to construct our environment in such a way that it's allowed us to extend our lifespan. So I don't think that's unnatural. We are a product of evolution by natural selection, and our abilities to develop cultural things like modern medicine are natural in that sense.
Okay, fine. So, but let's extend that. And let me say, just to be a little provocative, that there are some people who would claim that there is no really good theory of aging at all. There's no clock ticking, that it should be possible to extend life indefinitely, perhaps. That sounds a little unnatural, but could you just kind of gloss that?
Well, this raises the issue, and which personally I see as a very complicated one, about how long we ought to live. Let's imagine that tomorrow someone discovered a pill that could double human life expectancy. Would this be a good thing? Would we want something like that? I think that there are a lot of issues. There are economic issues and philosophical issues, social issues, as well as the basic biological issues. As an evolutionary biologist, the first reason that I'm most excited about studying aging is that I think it's a really fascinating, compelling scientific puzzle. And we've learned a huge amount in the last 15 or 20 years. Molecular biology has taught us an enormous amount about how organisms age. There are still fundamental evolutionary questions that we haven't resolved about why we age. I'm not going to give you a straight answer because I think it's a real ethical problem, and I'm not an ethicist. I don't know whether it's a good thing to double human life.
Let me ask you this thing, because it's confusing being in that meeting, hearing different sides. Are we programmed to die? Do we have term limits?
No. But I think you need to be clear about what you mean by programmed aging. So if you ask a biogerontologist, someone who studies the biology of aging, some biogerontologists will argue that aging is programmed, by which they mean that natural selection has actually favored the evolution of a cutoff time. The curtain falls, your time is over, and that natural selection has done that because that has somehow been good for the individual, or they might argue, I would disagree, I don't think evolution works this way, good for the species, that there is a built-in time when the curtain falls, and that's it. Personally, I think aging and longevity right now, expected lifespan, expected longevity in the United States is somewhere in the 80s. Maximum observed human lifespan is 122 and a half, Jean Calment in France some years ago. I don't think that natural selection has selected on 122 and a half as a cutoff. I think that maximum lifespan that we observe is kind of an epiphenomenon. It's a product of lots of other processes that have been under selection. How fast we grow, how fast we reproduce, how fast we reach maturity, and that all of the inner processes in our body, in any organism, that fail as they age are kind of a product of how selection has functioned to create a successful organism through growth and development and reproduction, and the way at which selection fails. It's not that selection selects for a cutoff time, but the cutoff time arises because of the failure of selection. Getting back to the beginning of our conversation, that selection The strength of selection declines as organisms get old. The ability of selection to weed out those deleterious effects gets weaker and weaker. And that's why we see these sort of term limits, that they're not set there by selection. They're a product of selection on lots of things happening earlier in life.
You have David Sinclair, Lenny Guarenti, the work on resveratrol, red wine, beneficial effects of that. So all interesting stuff. And as I said, you'd think there would be now some clearly set out theory of why we age. Jeffrey West made this point that we should be able to write down some sort of an equation and get a grip on this stuff. But that's not the case, is it?
Not yet. And here's where systems biology might be able to help us out. I think we have, generally speaking, two very broad categories of theory. We have the evolutionary theory that tells us why we age, partly because of the declining force of natural selection, possibly because of these trade-offs, these pleiotropic effects, some of which are beneficial, some of which are deleterious. That's the evolutionary theory. Kirkwood's work on the disposable soma, that there are trade-offs between investment in reproduction and investment in maintaining our body. That's sort of the evolutionary realm. There are lots of interesting evolutionary ideas that have developed over the last 50 years in parallel with the evolutionary theory of aging that haven't yet come together, and that's one of the areas that personally I'm interested in, integrating those evolutionary ideas. At the same time, there's a large body of what we might call mechanistic theories of aging, ideas that aging arises because of telomere shortening or because of the accumulation of oxidative damage caused by mitochondria, by respiration, these kind of mechanistic ideas. We could broadly classify them into the why theories and the how theories. There's a large body of literature on each of these, but very little overlap. And I think one possible promise of systems biology is to look at the systems of mechanistic phenomena associated with aging, whether it's mitochondria or telomeres or microRNAs or whatever people are looking at, and to think about how natural selection is acting on all of those different phenomena. So all of these things are interacting. How does selection act on a network, or in fact a network of networks acting at different levels of biological organization? I think we're a long way from being able to do that, but that's where I see systems biology playing a role, bringing together the fundamental evolutionary theories of why organisms age with the more mechanistic and often molecular theories of how organisms might age.
Maybe then calling for definitions of these things is premature, and maybe the finding out as we're going along and coming up with some practical solutions as we're going along is a good idea. For example, the mitochondrial theory of aging and DNA and so on, oxidative stress, those sorts of things. Maybe there are practical things that come out of these. Perhaps people should be making sure they get enough CoQ10 and stuff like that. Maybe you see where I'm going with this. There are other possible steps that we've learned as we've been going along through this study of the aging process that people at home can actually do that will improve their, so, apart from the obvious diet.
Well, so that's the thing. I think, you know, if we lived, and I'm glad that we live in a free society, but if we lived in a society where all of our actions were dictated by some dictatorial government, and that government wanted to maximize the lifespan of the people, they would force everybody to have a healthy diet and exercise regularly. And if everybody had a healthy diet, and I think we have a pretty good idea, nutritionists have a pretty good idea of what a healthy diet is, it's not too hard to have one, and how much exercise is good, we could dramatically increase lifespan in this country. We could decrease rates of all sorts of disease, diabetes and cancer and heart disease and so on. So I think all of those are critical. And personally, speaking not as a scientist, but just as a regular person, I think there's the quickest and cheapest way to increase lifespan is to get people to lead a healthy lifestyle. All of these other things, dietary supplements, or you know, people might even be interested in thinking about somehow changing, altering our gene expression or something like that. To me, those are most interesting. Studying those things is most interesting because we learn how organisms work, and in the study of aging, how and why they fail to work. So I don't work on humans, and I'm not pursuing, you know, I'm not looking for some treatment that is going to extend human lifespan. If other people want to do that, that's fine. But I think, you know, you say, well, aside from these other things, I think those other things are absolutely critical. And as a social issue, and aging obviously is a huge social issue in this country, all the work that people are doing on the biology of aging is really important. But the first place we need to look is basic lifestyle changes.
Okay, so as you're sitting in your lab looking at fruit flies, are you ever making the larger science and society connection as well and thinking about what the consequences would be of coming up with some aging fixes so that people live longer, so that there's a larger population, and then what happens in terms of global epidemics and so on and so on?
So here's my take on this. And when I look at fruit flies, what I'm really interested in is understanding what allows an organism to live for a certain amount of time and maintain a healthy, maintain a high status of health, high quality of life for that duration. You know, we talk about adding the cliche terms, adding years to life versus adding life to years. And I would say that the latter is really important. If you look at, and you know, again, I don't study economics or public policy, but if you look at the amount of money that we spend in this country in the last year of people's lives, if we could not simply increase lifespan, but increase the quality of life that people have until they die, I think that would be a gift to those people. It would dramatically reduce the amount of money that we spend on our healthcare system on that last year of life, maintaining people, helping people to stay alive, when for some, what they'd really like is not just to stay alive, but to be healthier while they're alive. So I think that really is an important place to focus. And when I study fruit flies, I'm interested in looking at not just how long flies live, but what kind of traits they're able to maintain as functioning while they're alive. A fly that's alive but can't do anything, any of the things that flies do, may not be much of a fly. And so the real challenge is to help people maintain a high quality of life while they're alive.
Yeah, optimize the planetary visit.
Yeah. And I mean, I was just in Cambodia a couple of months ago where the life expectancy is very low. And one might argue, well, if all of a sudden Cambodia, which is a very poor country, people were living a lot longer, there would be a lot more suffering. But I think these things are complicated. If people live longer, then they're inclined to have fewer children, to invest more in the children that they have. In fact, when we see longer lifespan, those things are correlated with slower population growth, higher quality of life. So I think, you know, extending lifespan, extending sort of normal healthy lifespan in that kind of situation can really be a good thing.
I'm curious, how did you get into this business in the first place?
Quite by accident. So as a graduate student, I was a graduate student at Oxford with Paul Harvey, and I was working on trying to understand differences among mammals, different species of mammals, in terms of how quickly they reach maturity and how many offspring they have and their gestation length, all of these traits that we call the life history strategy. Mm-hmm. And I looked at data from natural populations, and the best predictor of all of these traits, gestation length, litter size, age at maturity, all of these facets of the life history strategy, the best predictor was mortality rate in nature, the average mortality rate. And so I wrote up this study. It was my first study as a graduate student, and I felt really proud of myself. And then I didn't know what to do next. And my office mate, Graham Stone, who's still practicing biologist in England, said, well, you've got all this mortality data. Why don't you look at senescence? And that was 20 years ago now. And I did this one study on senescence, and everyone else in the lab was working on sexual selection, mating behavior, reproduction. And so everyone else was working on sex, and I was working on death. And I thought, well, I'll do this one study on death, and then I'm going to get back into the sex business. And here I am 20 years later, still working on aging. It's just a fascinating problem. The thing that I really love about doing science is that it allows me to bring together different ideas. My favorite kind of science happens when you take two different ideas that people didn't realize relate to each other, and you try and relate them to each other. The paper that we were talking about before we started this interview is an example of that. You take ideas from Williams and Medawar from the 1940s and 50s, ideas from Fisher in the 1930s, and you put them together in a way that people never thought to do, and you get something new. I love when that kind of thing happens. And the field of aging is, I can't think of a better field than aging for providing opportunities to bring together apparently disparate fields to create a kind of really exciting synergy that's scientifically exciting, that's intellectually compelling. So that's what's kept me in the field for 20 years.
But don't you think that there's a general misperception in the public at large that science is somehow this edifice that hands down pronouncements, whereas in fact, as you just said, it's more like a moving target. The stuff is shifting all the time. There's no certitude.
Absolutely. There's a big debate in this country right now about evolution and how important is evolution. Is natural selection the process that accounts for all of organic diversity? Or as many would argue, is it just the process that dots the I's and crosses the T's? Or as some might argue, does it have no role at all? As an evolutionary biologist, I have my own perspective on this. Sometimes people will say, well, you see, the two evolutionary biologists are arguing with each other. They can't agree on something. So that shows that there's some weakness. And in fact, when you have those kind of arguments, that's a sign of great strength in science, that science really moves forward when you find these disagreements. And then in working through the disagreements, often you find a third way that people hadn't thought about. That's the answer to some unsolved problems. So these kinds of dynamic processes are really what science is all about. When I teach courses in evolutionary biology or in genetics, we always use a textbook, but I try every day to bring in a paper from a recently published mm-hmm. journal to show that really science is not the static information in the textbook. Science is the process of discovery. And by the time it ends up in the textbook, often that process is kind of finished, and we've moved on to the next thing. And aging is definitely, the field of research on aging and biogerontology is definitely, it has that kind of vibrancy, that kind of tension where people are constantly arguing with each other about different approaches and at a theoretical level, you know, what are the right theories, what are the right tools, and what are the right questions. And the fact that we don't have answers to a basic question like what's the right theory or what tools should we use, in my mind, makes for a very vibrant kind of science.
And that was evidenced in the last few days in the meeting, and the mood would shift from exhilaration sometime when people found they were on the same track to sheer frustration when they realized they were talking past each other with different theories or having different definitions of the same thing. What at this point do you think has emerged from this? What did you learn?
I'll answer that question, but first let me give you a very personal perspective on how science works. So often what happens at meetings like these is people make connections with each other and connections with ideas that they didn't expect to make. So Lou Lipsitz gave a great talk about his work on complexity in humans and looking at things like heart rate and showing that as we get older, not that the heart rate stays the same, but the complexity of the slight changes that you see in heart rate from minute to minute or hour to hour changes, that in the elderly, that the complexity goes down. The changes in their heart rate are not as complex as what you see in a young adult. And it was a really fascinating talk. And he was talking about how sometimes adding a little bit of noise to a system can help bring back the complexity. And I've been thinking about noise and complexity in gene expression. So this morning, before breakfast, Lou and I sat down and we talked for half an hour about noise and complexity, not in terms of heart rate or gait balance, which is something that Lou is very interested in, but in terms of gene expression and how some genes have high levels of expression in their constant, some have low levels of expression in their constant, and some move around a lot. And we actually hatched an idea for a project to look at some data that I happen to have. He has novel ways of looking at the data. So whether this is going to tell us about aging, I don't know, but we have an idea came out of his talk and my having thought about some other things and realizing that what he was doing could inform the questions that I had. So often what happens at meetings like this is that people come together in that way and realize that there's an opportunity for scientific discovery that they didn't realize, because one person has the data, one person has the statistical tool, and they can bring them together. So that kind of thing is always happening at scientific meetings, and it's great. It's just it's a wonderful thing that happens at meetings. This meeting was designed partly to help us figure out how to move the field of systems biology of aging forward. And I think we'll know in a year whether it's successful or not. So from a very practical perspective, the National Institutes of Health want scientists to send their best ideas to NIH and ask for money to fund the research to explore those ideas. NIH would love for those of us who are here working maybe with other people as well who aren't at this meeting to come up with ideas for how to move the field of systems biology of aging forward, send those ideas to NIH in a nice package that we call a grant proposal, ask for funds, and if they deem that the scientific ideas are worthy, they'll give us the funds and we'll move those things forward. The challenge that we have right now is a very practical challenge, and that is coming up with those ideas. Mm-hmm. And as we speak here, one hopes that's what folks in the other room are doing, is thinking about those ideas. Yesterday, near Barzilai, I think for a heuristic purpose, just for helping us to see what's possible, he said, okay, well, I'm just going to stand up here and I'm going to outline one kind of grant that we could write that would involve four laboratories, each laboratory working on a different aspect of one particular problem, and that is what role epigenetics plays in the aging process. By epigenetics, we mean those parts of the genome that affect the phenotype, not due to the sequence of the genes, the base pairs, but due to other factors that influence whether a gene is expressed or not. We talk about things like methylation. And
which are environmental effects during the lifespan.
Right. Or things we inherit from our the experiences that our mother had when we were in utero, and those sorts of things. And so from a very practical point of view, thinking about how science works, one thing that comes out of these meetings is new ideas. Who knows, Lou and I may end up publishing a paper that will be a little bit of contribution to one area of science. Another very practical thing that comes out is scientists coming together and figuring out what kind of questions we need to ask, what the answers might look like, and putting together grant proposals, getting funding from the federal government, doing the research and increasing our knowledge and helping us understand why organisms age and maybe helping people to live healthier, longer lives.
So you've got to get back to your meeting, but one last question. When I asked you earlier why you were doing this at all, you gave me an answer that was really why you got into the death business rather than into the sex business. but why did you do science at all? Why science?
As an undergraduate, I actually had no idea what to do. I didn't know whether I was going to major in philosophy or in biology, no idea. What excites me about science is I'm paid to grapple with conceptually challenging ideas, and I have the opportunity to bring together disparate ideas to create something new. I think personally, I could be happy doing just about anything in life that gave me the opportunity to encounter intellectually challenging and compelling ideas and to bring together disparate ideas to create something new. I was lucky enough to stumble on the field of evolutionary biology, and biogerontology is a way to do that. And that's why I'm in science. But personally, I imagine that I could have stumbled into a different path outside of science that would have provided those same opportunities. I'm very glad that I'm a scientist. I love my job. I wouldn't trade it in for anything. But that's really, it's about intellectual challenges and idea synergy. That's really what I love about doing science.
Right, great, thanks very much.
All right, it was a pleasure.